Perspectives on Public Interest. I'm Emily Brennan, and here's your pro bono news update. The National Immigration Law Center has launched a new blog called The Torch. Established in 1979, the National Immigration Law Center is one of the leading organizations in the U.S. exclusively dedicated to defending and advancing the rights of low-income immigrants. The premier blog posts on The Torch examine a range of issues that impact immigration, from healthcare to deportation. Learn more at nilc.org. Human Rights First recently examined the historic UN Human Rights Council resolution on sexual orientation and gender, noting that the new mandate will be an opportunity for progress on human rights globally and for addressing the persistent forms of violence that people face based on their real or perceived sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression. Read the blog post at humanrightsfirst.org. And finally, leaders at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia met on a variety of public service issues, including criminal justice reform. An article from generosity.org titled, 10 Ideas from Local Leaders That Might Move Criminal Justice Reform Forward, recaps a DNC forum hosted by The Atlantic that explored how we should start rethinking what crime and punishment should look like. If you want to learn more about events at the DNC in Philadelphia, you can read coverage from Penn Law students on regblog.org. That's it for the update. Here's our interview with Joanna Viscera Joyan, co-founder of the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project.
Welcome, everyone, to the Perspectives in Public Interest podcast. I'm Arlene Vera Finkelstein, and for this episode, I'm joined by Joanna Viscera Joyan, co-founder and co-director of the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project, a Philadelphia-based nonprofit focused on improving outcomes for young people in the criminal justice system. Thank you so much for joining us, Joanna. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's jump right into what your organization is all about. Can you tell us about YSRP?
Sure. We are a new Philadelphia-based nonprofit, as you said, and we're working directly with kids who are prosecuted in the adult criminal justice system. In Pennsylvania, kids can be in the adult criminal justice system as young as 10 years old if they're charged with homicide offenses. Our goal is to move their cases out of the adult criminal justice system, back to the juvenile justice system, and hopefully out of all systems altogether. And what's unique about our work is that we stay on as a resource for the kids, not just as their cases are moving through the system, through the courts, whether it's the adult system or the juvenile side, but as they come home and as they continue on in their lives. We often say that our goal is not to impact the outcome of an individual case, but an individual young person's life.
Why the special focus on youth in the criminal justice system?
Well, you know, when I first learned that we were locking kids up in adult jails and prisons, I was blown away. I couldn't figure out why this wasn't an issue that was being shouted from rooftops across the city, across the state, across the country. And for both me and my co-director, Lauren Fine, and our colleagues and supporters, we felt like it was something we really had to dedicate time and resources to. We don't believe that kids belong in adult jails or adult prisons. And that's really the core function of our organization and our core value statement.
Now, their age makes them extremely sympathetic. Mm-hmm. But as you acknowledge, they're generally detained for extremely serious crimes and often found guilty of extremely serious crimes. Can you talk about the tension between those two aspects of your clients?
Absolutely. You know, in every single one of our cases, a tragedy has occurred of some sort. Someone has felt less safe in their community. There has been perhaps some element of violence or the use of a weapon, and we always want to acknowledge that. And we always want to acknowledge the impact that actions have had on the community. At the same time, we don't think that our clients are disposable. We don't think that they should be locked up with the key thrown away because of bad decisions they've made and perhaps experiences that amount to the worst moment in their lives. We believe that every child is redeemable.
Now, you talk about the decisions they've made. Part of your work hinges on talking about a child's ability to engage in that kind of decision-making process. Can you talk about developmentally what makes this population unique and vulnerable?
I'm so glad that you said that, because I should have said the decisions they've made in the context of their adolescent brains. And what we have begun to acknowledge more broadly, which I'm really glad to say, but that an issue that's been recognized by our United States Supreme Court, by some of the highest bodies in our land that say juvenile brains are different. They're different from adult brains, and brains don't fully develop until, some would say, mid-20s. And so to hold kids accountable for decisions they're making when they're 13, 14, 15 years old to the same standard that we would hold a 35-year-old or 45-year-old just really doesn't make good sense. And we believe, as many have said, that kids should be treated as kids in systems that are designed to serve them, to serve us as a community, and to help them move on to more productive paths with positive outcomes.
So how does that translate in the courtroom with your clients? How does the criminal justice system look at the developmental status of the children that you represent?
So we infuse that information into every case we work on, and every young person on whose behalf we are providing advocacy. And what that looks like in a more technical sense, we work with generally court-appointed and private defense attorneys in the Philadelphia court system who have been assigned to represent young people charged as adults. And we develop mitigation reports or sentencing narratives where we gather as much information as we possibly can about the young person, him or herself, their family history, their life context, all of the factors that have played a role in who they've become up to that moment, where they find themselves in court facing often really serious charges, as we've discussed. And part of what we're doing is saying to the court, here is a much broader explanation of who this young person is beyond just the arrest report or the one piece of paper a judge might have when they come to make a very crucial decision. Here are some of the traumatic experiences they've had, but also here are the things that show how resilient they are. And we often want to talk or always want to talk about trauma as it compares to the resiliency factors that kids are exhibiting. Here are their strengths along with the challenges. And so all of that is related to their brain development, to all the things that we've talked about that have been acknowledged by the highest courts in how kids are different. And we use that in a very individualized way, try to convince the courts that kids' cases don't belong in the adult system and really ought to be in juvenile courts.
So to be clear, you're not saying that kids are not guilty. It's not sort of not guilty by reason of youth.
That's right. But we really don't get into guilt innocence. We are painting a picture of who the young person is, and we do this in partnership with their attorneys, whose job it is to argue their cases in court, to prove innocence if that is the way that the case is moving, to enter into a plea agreement if that is what makes more sense with the prosecutor. Our role, although we are attorneys, is to support their advocacy efforts by painting this much broader and more textured picture of who the client is.
So yours is a really unique model. You're not the defense attorney of record. Tell us more specifically about how you work and why you decided that this kind of model was the kind of advocacy that kids really needed in the system.
So we engage with, again, court-appointed or private attorneys who are assigned to cases when the public defender's office is conflicted out or not able to represent an individual young person. So that probably doesn't mean a whole lot. Let me take a step back and explain how one of these cases might come to us or might come to the system. Let's say three young people, they're 16 years old, they have been arrested and charged with an armed robbery with the use of a BB gun, which is what we're seeing in a lot of our cases. The three young people, none of them can afford to hire an attorney. One of them is assigned to the public defender's office here in Philadelphia. For conflict of interest reasons, the other two cannot receive representation from that same office. So they will be assigned a court-appointed attorney from a list that the court maintains to represent them in their case. And this might be an individual solo practitioner in the community who doesn't have access to the same resources that the public defender's office has. They don't have social workers on staff. They maybe haven't been trained in the same types of adolescent neuroscience that we've been talking about in this conversation, and are strapped. They're being paid very limited fees by the court, flat rates in a lot of cases, and could use some additional resources and support. And that's where we step in. We reach out to them. They often reach out to us. We've gotten our cases in a variety of ways. And we say, let us help you bridge the gap and provide your case with some additional resources. And we do that free of cost as a nonprofit organization and enter in as essentially mitigation specialists, which is a term that's more common in the death penalty world, where mitigation specialists work on cases after the guilt innocence phase and during the sentencing phase, where a judge or jury is determining whether someone should be sentenced to death or not. We are applying a lot of those same tools and mechanisms to cases where kids are facing charges in the adult criminal justice system.
Who's your youngest client been so far?
15 has been our youngest so far, although we are always prepared to have clients who are much younger than that. As I mentioned in the beginning, just last year, in a county outside of Philadelphia, a kid who was 10 years old was charged as an adult in a murder case and held in an adult jail and given crayons and coloring books and video games in recognition of his young age. But our statutory structure here in Pennsylvania did not allow for him to be held in a juvenile facility.
He was accused of killing someone.
He was accused of that, yes.
When you are working with children as clients who have weapons and who inflict serious harm to another, you encounter a lot of fear, a lot of stereotypes, a lot of assumptions that it doesn't matter how old the perpetrator is, there's a weapon and someone is dead. How do you approach your process of adding context and humanizing the perpetrator of such a serious crime?
Yeah, you know, you hear a lot of the rhetoric of adult crime, adult time. A lot of the reason that we have come to this place with the laws that we have was, I would say, fear-mongering that occurred over the past 20, 30 years around the juvenile super predator. Unfortunately, we've moved away from a lot of that language, from this idea that these hyper-violent teenagers were going to be unleashed onto our communities and that we should all be deeply afraid of kids who were going to be terrorizing our neighborhoods and homes and schools. We've moved away from some of that rhetoric, but the laws remain on the books that allow for us to charge and treat children as if they were adults. And that, again, is what we always go back to. And it's not to diminish the seriousness of the charges that our clients are facing or the seriousness of the impact that communities have felt as a result. But it's to say that it's not as black and white as adult crime, adult time, that young people under the age of, let's say, 24, 25 are in need of treatment and rehabilitation if we hope for them to be productive, contributing members of our communities. And that doesn't mean putting them in an adult jail or prison. It means allowing them to complete their education, receive therapeutic supports that they might need, and to develop some workforce skills. And what I haven't talked about are some of the reentry supports that we are also providing to our clients, along with the mitigation work that we're doing in their cases. So in every report that we submit to the court, we're also developing something of a roadmap for how they might come home successfully. So often, reentry planning occurs a few months before a young person is coming home, whether it's home from a juvenile facility or an adult jail. And it's not tied to their individual needs and to issues that they were dealing with long before they went into any kind of incarceration. And we're saying that kind of planning and thoughtfulness around reentry and the tools that young people need to succeed needs to happen way earlier. It needs to happen at the sentencing phase for there to be any hope of successful reintegration and a lack of return to the system that they just left.
So you mentioned that your work is centering around sort of changing perceptions and working against some old laws that are still on the books with this sort of old notion of what young people should face. Fortunately, you find yourself, YSRP finds itself at the center of a really significant change in law with regard to life without parole sentences for juveniles and a really significant impact on Pennsylvania in particular. Can you talk about what that change in law has been and the impact on your work here in Pennsylvania?
Absolutely. Well, part of the reason that we came to this work was involvement that we had had and work that we had done with families who had loved ones serving life without parole sentences imposed when they were under the age of 18. Hundreds of families across the state of Pennsylvania whose loved ones had been locked up for decades, their children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, sisters, brothers. And this is in the context of a series of cases at the U.S. Supreme Court level, starting back in 2005 when the court said, finally, we're going to stop executing children, something that we were doing until 2005, which is often surprising to people that we talk to. Not that long ago. And the court, and that was the Roper v. Simmons case, started developing a lot of language that we've been talking about in this conversation about kids being different and courts and systems needing to treat them as such. The court looked at amicus briefs submitted by the American Psychological Association and others talking about adolescent brain development. And it was through these series of cases, beginning with Roper, moving on to a case called Graham v. Florida, where they said life without parole sentences for non-homicide offenses were unconstitutional. Kids were being locked up for life for robberies, for example, where no life was lost. And that was in the Graham case in 2010. The court said, we are not going to continue to do that. And they kept building towards treating kids differently, saying the kids needed to be treated differently in the courts. Finally, in 2012, in a case called Miller v. Alabama, the court said it was unconstitutional to sentence kids to life in prison without parole on a mandatory basis in first and second degree homicide cases. What the court did not address in 2012 was whether or not that decision applied retroactively. So looking at all of the sentences that had become final before that time. And that's where Pennsylvania really started grappling with this issue. Our highest court here said, well, the Miller decision is not retroactive, meaning that hundreds of people across the state of Pennsylvania were not eligible for any relief, even though the sentences they were serving had been deemed unconstitutional by the highest court. And so there was a lot of litigation. Long story short, in January of this year, in a case called Montgomery v. Louisiana, the court said, actually, indeed, the Miller case was retroactive, is retroactive. And that means that there is now a possibility for resentencing and relief for thousands of people across the country. And as you said, this impact is felt most acutely here in Pennsylvania, where we have the largest number of people serving the sentence. We have 500 people across the state of Pennsylvania who were sentenced to life in prison without parole on a mandatory basis, and that is out of 2,000 nationwide. We have 300 of that number here in Philadelphia County. Philadelphia County, the total number is just under the total for the state of Michigan, which is the next largest state. Pennsylvania is followed by Michigan and then Louisiana in terms of the highest numbers. So we are really the epicenter here when it comes to having sentenced children to life in prison without parole, and the country, and I think in a lot of ways the rest of the world, is looking at what we're going to do in response. And so because a lot of our work stemmed from this initial engagement with families who had loved ones serving these sentences, it felt only right and only natural and a true extension of our mission to be doing a lot of the same work around mitigation and reentry planning on behalf of the men and women who were sentenced to life in prison without parole. And we really are thinking about it in a continuum model. On the one end of the spectrum, it's kids who are just moving into the adult system now, and those are the young people we've been talking about throughout this conversation. And on the other end of the spectrum are people who have been sitting in adult jails for decades, since they were teenagers, and they are now in their 40s, 50s, 60s. And in some cases, in the example of Mr. Joe Ligon, he is the longest serving, we think, juvenile lifer in the world. He's just about 45 minutes outside of Philadelphia at SCI Greaterford, and he's 78 years old. He's been in prison since 1953. And so it's cases like Mr. Ligon's that we are working as hard as we can on behalf of and hoping to have positive outcomes here in Philadelphia.
Now, to be clear, these folks were all convicted and sentenced for extremely serious crimes. But the Supreme Court held, after a lot of litigation that you described, that their crime did not reflect irreparable corruption. Or at least that they should be given the opportunity to show their crime did not reflect irreparable corruption. And if it did not, their hope for some years of life outside prison walls must be restored. What does that work even begin to look like for advocacy like yours in terms of helping someone get a fresh start after decades in jail?
Well, that's a million-dollar question, and I'm so glad that you referenced that quote, because that's really my favorite quote from the beautiful decision authored by Justice Kennedy in the Montgomery case. Some hope outside of prison walls means the kind of reentry planning that we believe needs to be done in every single case, but that we've been really focused on in our front end cases where kids are just entering the adult system and hopefully moving out, as we discussed. We are working in coalition and partnership with reentry service providers across the city and with colleagues at other legal services organizations to figure out what needs to be in place to truly support men and women as they're coming home, previously having thought that they would never be coming home, having not had access to programs and resources during their periods of incarceration because the Department of Correction said, well, they're juvenile lifers and we need to prioritize in terms of who we're providing access to. And so the DOC has been a partner in all of this. They've been opening up programming and resources to the juvenile lifer population as these cases have been moving through the system. But there is still a significant need. There is a lot of work that needs to be done. This is an unprecedented situation. And the support can't end once the resentencings occur. It needs to be ongoing, thoughtful, and individualized reentry support for years to come.
What prospects are there for things like employment when someone is released with this serious a record into the community?
You know, that's a really difficult question. And we've talked to a lot of experts who are in the workforce development and reentry employment spaces. And they've said for a lot of these men and women, employment might not be a realistic option. If you have been in for 50 or 60 years, coming home with a first or second degree murder conviction, to be completely frank, it's going to be an issue. Employment is hard enough for people who are coming home from incarceration with less serious convictions. And that's something that there's a lot of work that needs to happen on that in the city. But we want to make sure that people are set up with the public benefits that they should have access to so that they can be feeling supported in their communities and work with employers, hopefully, who will be open-minded enough to truly give people a second chance. And know that people have been working for decades behind the wall in kitchens, in janitorial services, doing a lot of the hard labor skills that are needed. And we are truly hopeful that opportunities will be there.
Is there any sense of why Philadelphia is at the epicenter of this life without parole sentencing?
Part of it, and there are a couple of answers to this, is that we've had mandatory sentencing for first and second degree murder convictions on the books for as long as most people can remember, with no individualized consideration. And I should be clear, you know, saying first and second degree is a felony murder conviction where someone might have been involved in the commission of an underlying felony but did not pull the trigger. Perhaps what they were standing on the corner as a lookout, as many of the men and women in Pennsylvania were, and might not have even known that a murder was going to take place or that someone's life might be lost in the commission of another felony, and they were convicted of second-degree murder and on a mandatory basis sentenced to life in prison without parole. In fact, a lot of the cases that we're talking about were originally death penalty convictions that were converted to life sentences in 2005 when the Roper decision came down. Pennsylvania, that's one of the reasons that we have been an outlier. I think it's one of the more significant reasons, and we would probably need a whole other podcast to talk about the lengthy history here in Pennsylvania on how this has all come to be.
Can you tell us a little bit about the impact this has on a community when you referenced your work with parents and families? And I'm thinking about the huge number of families impacted just by the number of people you've mentioned being impacted by these resentencings on life without parole.
Absolutely. And it's twofold. It's both the families who have maintained guarded optimism for decades that their loved ones might one day come home. But it's also the victims' families that are deeply impacted by this. And this goes back to our earlier conversation about it not being a black and white issue. We can't be thinking about it in sort of a binary way. It's hugely complicated. And just as we are hoping that there are supports available to the juvenile lifers as they're coming home, we are also very hopeful that supports will be available to the victims' families across the state who are for the first time dealing with the possibility of people who they thought were never coming home returning to the community and what that means in terms of healing going forward.
In terms of going forward, you know, there is a fundamental optimism embedded in your mission, in the mission of your organization. A lot of folks are looking at the criminal justice system, at police community relations right now with less optimism. Can you tell us what about your work with your clients gives you hope that change is possible.
It's hard in these days to feel hugely positive and optimistic, quite frankly. We're coming off of a very difficult week for racial justice work in this country, for community police relations. And I sometimes honestly struggle to see the silver lining, but I do believe that at its core, our work is premised on optimism, on a belief that the system is capable of change, and that we are at a pivotal moment in our country in terms of criminal justice reform. It's being talked about at the national level in a much deeper way than it ever has been before. It's part of the national dialogue and parlance in a way that I am feeling hopeful and proud of some days. And it just takes having a conversation with our young clients and also now the juvenile lifers that we have been working with to know that they haven't let go of their hope despite really miserable circumstances. And that means none of us should either. They are committed to continuing to fight for this maintained hopeful optimism. And that gives me hope every day when I get up to go to work and continue doing this.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Joanna. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today, and we thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you for this opportunity.
And thanks to our listeners. We look forward to having you join us again for our next episode of Perspectives in Public Interest.
This podcast was produced by the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Learn more about public interest lawyering at law.upenn.edu/public service. Thanks for joining us.